Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you from Radio City, the KMJ studios again tonight. Each and every week, we talk to everyday Americans whose service in World War II produced the free country that we know today. And today, we meet another everyday American, a young man who grew up the youngest of 10 children in Beaumont, Texas, turned into a household name in our country because of his all-star status as a big league slugger, a guy that you know quite a bit about. Most of the veterans we've talked to are probably people you hadn't heard of before, and hopefully by hearing some of their experiences, you come to a newfound respect for those people and for veterans in general. Today, it's someone that you have heard of, that you've heard on the radio, seen on TV, maybe have a baseball card at home of, but hopefully you'll hear some stories you may have not heard before. There's a new book out, Ozark Ike, Memories of Fencebuster Gus Zernial, and the great Gus Zernial, my guest today. Gus, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Paul, it's nice to be with you.
And it's an honor for me to spend some time with a real radio and TV pioneer here in the Valley. I know that wasn't your plan when you were growing up in Beaumont, Texas. And let's talk, before we get into your service during the war and your time as a big leaguer, you're the youngest of 10 children in Beaumont, Texas. And in reading through this book, I learned something that I had no idea about. From the time you were 7 to the time you were 9, you couldn't even get out of the house, let alone swing a baseball bat.
Well, I'd started school, Paul, and just shortly after I started school, wintertime was coming along, and I developed what they called a bronchial pneumonia, and it caused an enlargement of the heart. Well, back in those days, they were really concerned, and probably didn't know how to treat it or what have you, so they put me in bed, and the doctor said, we're going to have to keep him in bed for quite a long time. And I got used to the idea, but my mom and my dad really took good care of me, and I could tell you a lot of stories about what they did for me, but I wasn't able to get out and move around much until I was 9 years old. And that's what happened to me at a young age, and of course I think I grew up all right. The heart probably was all right. It's at 84, it's not ticking on the right all the time. But I got a pacemaker now, so I got a new engine.
Well, I imagine that all that did was make you that much hungrier to actually get a chance to go out and play some ball and do some of the things that you weren't able to do while you were holed up, even though having your dad bring home ice cream every day probably was a perk at the time.
Well, that made me gain a lot of weight and get bigger. I remember the first time that Mom and Dad let me out of the house. We were kind of people that raised chickens and grew a garden and that kind of stuff. And the first day I got out in the yard, I don't think I'd ever seen a chicken before at that time. And I started chasing those chickens around. And that leads into another story, which we may get to. But I did. I ran around the house, and then I got interested in baseball. I was interested before I got sick. And then I got interested in baseball again, and at 9 years of age, I wanted to be a ball player.
Well, and we'll talk more about this book as the afternoon wears on here, but I've been reading through it this week since Gus was kind enough to let me look at a copy. And the hardcover version sell for $25. There's also a limited edition for $50, which is signed by Gus. There are only 237 of those that'll ever be printed because that's how many home runs Gus hit in the major leagues. There's a list of all those home runs in the back. And you'll see some amazing stories in here, some great baseball stories that only someone who was there would be able to tell. Gus was there. He was a big league all-star. Some incredible records that we'll talk about as the program goes on. You're growing up in Beaumont, Texas, which happened to be where the Tigers had their double-A team, so you saw some of the all-time greats there as a young boy.
Well, you know, as a young man, I remember very well when I used to be in the knothole gang. They had, I guess you were 15 years old, you could go and be in the knothole. Well, the guys I was watching, they were only 19 or 20. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the guys I saw play for Beaumont that went to the Tigers, I eventually played against in the big leagues. In fact, the story is in the book, I think, that the first guy I faced when I got, it was in Detroit, the first time I'd ever seen a big league stadium. I'd played against a lot of big league players. But Hal Neuhauser was on the mound. And Hal Neuhauser was one of my favorites when I was watching the Tigers are the Exporters, which was a Tiger Farm Club, play down in Beaumont. So it leads into a lot of good things that happened to me in my early career in baseball because, as I said, I played against those guys.
And if you look through the list in the back of Gus's book of all 237 home runs, including those four in a doubleheader that closed out the 1950 season, the 7-4 games, a record for the American League that happened in 1951, you'll also find on that list a couple home runs off of Hal Newhouser.
Yes.
You got that privilege.
Later on, I got to hit a pair off of Hal, yes.
And eventually, you get through with high school. You're a basketball star in high school, too. There's a great picture in the book of a couple pictures of you playing basketball. You knew baseball was something you were good at. You got a tryout and a chance to prove yourself for some of the professional scouts.
Well, that happened in 1941. And about six of us kids from Beaumont got into a car, drove to Houston, Texas. That was 90 miles away. I'd never been that far out of Beaumont. And Branch Rickey, head of the Cardinals back in those days, there was about 350 kids, I think, reported. You know, some of them could play ball. Some couldn't even hardly get on the ball field. I don't remember all that. But the first time I ever saw Branch Rickey, he looked at me, and he was a skinny kid. I was probably in dungarees. I may have had a uniform. I don't remember. But he looked at me, and he said, "Run." Well, you know, you're a 17-year-old kid, and here's a guy. I knew who Branch Rickey was because I followed baseball. And I took off running, and I run back to him. He says, "You're my first baseman." And I had an outfielder's glove in my hand. So, it's just the opposite. I had a first base glove because I played first base.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "You're my outfielder, center fielder," and I had a first base glove. I had to trade gloves with somebody. Anyway, that's the way I got my start. And they wanted to sign me to a contract to finish up that 1941 year. That was like in June or something like that I was over there.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted to send me to Hamilton, Ontario. And I got home. I said, "Well, let me go home and talk to Mom." My dad had passed away. And I went home and asked Mom. I said, "Mom, where's Hamilton, Ontario?" She says, "I don't know." Well, we were all born in South Texas down there, you know, and even though I knew about the world map and everything, I should have known where that was. But we called back and talked to another gentleman and asked him where they would like, if they wanted me to play in 42. And they said, "Yeah, we'd like for him to report to Albany, Georgia." Well, we know where Georgia was, Southern. So that's how I got started in my career.
Albany, Georgia is a lot closer to Beaumont, Texas than Hamilton, Ontario is. And, of course, the listeners to this show, since we talk about veterans and World War II so much, certainly know what happened on December 7th, 1941. Here you are in the spring of 1942. You play for the Cardinals a little bit in the Georgia-Florida League. Then, with all the guys getting drafted, it really shook up the minor leagues. You end up finishing that season with the Atlanta organization. And after that season, you were starting to realize that you might not get to play baseball for a while because they lowered the draft age from 21 to 18.
And I became 18 or 19 that summer. And I didn't wait for Uncle Sam to, you know, that big sign that says, "I want you." I didn't pay any mind to that. I joined with my nephew, Billy Zernial, which is a story in itself, too. And we went into the Navy in October of 1942.
And I think that's a good stopping point for now as we get to our first commercial break. What did Gus Zernial experience in the Navy? What about his nephew, Billy? And what promise did he make that ended up coming back to him tenfold as his life would progress? You're listening to Hometown Heroes with our special guest, Gus Zernial, today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty. On 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I'm your host, Paul Leffler. A little later on in the program, we'll take a few phone calls at 490-5858 or toll-free 800-776-5858. We're talking to baseball legend Gus Zernial, led the American League in and runs batted in back in 1951. That was about 10 years after the Pearl Harbor attack and about 9 years after Gus joined the Navy. His new book, Ozark Ike, Memories of Fence Buster Gus Zernial, a terrific read. And one thing I love about this book, Gus, is not just all the great pictures in there and your explanations of them, but the way the chapters are set up, it's really easy to read. You don't have to sit down for 4 hours and pour through the whole thing. you can read a chapter at a time, get a whole story, and really enjoy it and not feel like you're stuck trying to read the rest of the book in one sitting.
That was done on by design. I wanted it that way.
Well, you did a good job with it, certainly. We left off with you joining the Navy with your nephew Billy in October of 1942. And once you joined the Navy, sure, they noticed that you were a pretty big strapping boy and you could load some anti-aircraft guns, ammunition, but they also figured out that you had a pretty good ear and that you'd be all right listening to radio alerts. You became a radio man.
I was really surprised at that because when we got through with the part in the Navy where they tell you where to go, they sent Billy directly to the Navy, and they sent me to the University of Idaho, and they told me they were going to teach me radio signals. Well, I'd never heard anything like that in my life, but I put the earphones on, and, you know, they would go, dot. I can still remember some of it, you know, dot, 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 and dash, 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 dot, 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 SOS if you want. Mm-hmm. But I picked it up right away, and you had to read something like, I think to graduate, 25 words a minute, mm-hmm. or something like that you had, or type it or whatever. But I graduated, and they gave me a... I became a radio man first class. So all of a sudden here I'm aboard ship and I'm tending radio. I'm not in the Navy. I thought being in the Navy I'd be on a battleship or a carrier or something like that. But here I was standing watches midnight till 4 and 8 to 4, whatever the watch needed. And I just listened to Mercigs all the time. And of course, there was radio silence in the Navy at that time, and all I did was tape messages where certain submarines or certain vessels the enemy might be, and if it came across it and we were in that area, then I would inform the captain. And but we never got into too much danger till we got to Calcutta.
Well, you have a good story about that in the book. You're part of a transport ship, and you're heading toward Calcutta to supply the China-Burma-India Theater, taking some P-40s, actually, to General Chenault's outfit, as I imagine was their eventual destination. And you guys spotted something that was circling around you.
Well, to get the story, we were taking P-40s, but they were in crates, big gray crates. And, of course, the ships were all painted gray in those days, and so... We got into the Indian Ocean, and General Quarters said it was sounded early in the morning. And we all got into our places and radio and stuff like that. And at the time, there was somebody else on radio, so I was manning a gun. And I was big enough to handle the 350 projectiles and stuff like that. And so we saw this ship, and that ship during the day would circle us. Beyond the horizon, of course, and it circled us all day long. And of course, we stayed on general quarters because we knew the Japanese had a counter gunship called a Q-boat.
Right.
I think some of you Navy guys out there will remember that they had a Q-boat, and we didn't know what it was at the time, but we stayed on general quarters all day, and then of course all night. And, you know, how much can you see at night? And we got up the next morning, and it was gone.
And to explain a little bit more about what a Q-boat is, it looks just like any other Japanese merchant ship, but there's some hidden cargo there that could do you a little damage.
Well, once they would spot a merchant ship like ours, they would just come close, drop the sides, and they had surface guns. I mean, 5-inch guns or what have you, big barrel guns, and just blow you out of the water, and that was it. But they never came in on us, and we were wondered about that at the time. When we got to Calcutta, of course, the officer went aboard, talked to the commander of the base there, and his word came back was that the reason that this Japanese ship did not attack us because they thought we were a counter Q-boat because of the gray stuff we had on the side on our boxes, and they were afraid we were traveling at very slow speeds, and the whole consensus was that we were trying to draw them in so that we could blow them out of the water. Well, we didn't have anything much bigger than a 20 millimeter, so anyway, that was the story, and that saved our lives.
So regardless of whether those P-40s ever did anything in the skies over Guilin or Shanghai or anywhere in that theater, they saved your life, so those P-40s did enough job for you.
Without firing a shot.
Without even being assembled, still
That's
in the
right.
crates. That's one of the great stories that you'll read in Gus's book, Ozark Ike, Memories of Fencebuster Gus Zernial. And if you want to order a copy of that book, probably the best way to do it at this point, and pretty soon there'll be some other methods that you can track it down, but for now you can email Gus in care of the Fresno Grizzlies. That address is G Zernial, that's G-Z-E-R-N-I-A-L, at FresnoGrizzlies.com, and he'll make sure that you get a copy. Again, they're $25 for the hardcover edition. There are 1,000 of those ready to go right now. There are 237 limited edition copies that have his autograph and a DVD that goes along with it that has some great material. One for each of the 237 home runs that he hit. We're still a long way from you hitting your first big league home run because you still have the rest of the war to get through. And I know while you were experiencing what you experienced, and once you finally got to Calcutta, it was no picnic either. They were bombing you every day, and somehow you were protected.
Every day for 17 days, the Japanese bombed that area. And, of course, after the bombings, then the Zeros would come in, and of course, our P-38s, I think we had at the time, would take over. And there were, the Zeros are no match for us in the air at all. But the bombers, man, they come in droves. But, you know, I was very fortunate, Paul. We were anchored most of the time because there was not a place for us to get in at the particular time to the dock. And, man, they were dropping bombs. I think there was five key ports around Calcutta.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, we were there. They bombed us every day. But the good Lord was looking out for me at that time, I think, and the rest of us on that particular ship because we didn't get hit.
We have some other experiences during the war that I want to talk to you about, but let me sidetrack a little bit now. You talked about how you joined with your nephew, Billy, who really was like a brother to you. He was 6 months younger than you were because you were the last of 10 children. You get sent your different ways. Obviously, we know you made it. You're here talking to us today. Billy didn't make it home. He was killed in the Pacific. Is that something that at the time you thought, wow, I guess, you know, God had a plan for me. I could have been in Billy's shoes.
Well, you know, this, I think, happened in early 19, I believe it was 44, that Billy, and of course, I didn't know, had no way of knowing it at the time. And when I got on the island after I'd been at sea quite a while and after the family knew that, you know, Billy had been killed. Well, I guess the family wrote or did something, and they decided to keep me on the base at Treasure Island. It was a summertime at that time, and so they kept me on base, and I wrote some material, which you get into later, that the commander up in Portland found out about. And I wrote some articles for the Navy at that particular time. Also, there was a specialist A in the Navy at that time. I guess it stood for athlete or something. I don't know what it was. But they discovered that I was on the island and that I had played ball. And that leads into another story if you want to talk about baseball. But they kept me up, didn't want to send me to sea for at least 6 months.
And that gave you a chance to play some baseball with the Navy there in that district. And I know you had a lot of fun doing that. Eventually, you would end up in the Pacific when the war came to an end. And I know before they dropped the bombs in Japan and you got to come home, you had another close call where you got some leave or you got some liberty. You decided to go ashore and explore Manila, not realizing what the danger zone that was.
Well, we were a bunch of gobs. We didn't know what was going on land. And we landed at a place called Batangas Bay, I think it was, where we dropped off some Army equipment and stuff like that. And I don't know how many days we were there, but I remember what we had a leave on a weekend, and a guy by the name of Hubbard, a gunner's mate, he may be around today somewhere, but we decided that we would hitchhike. It was 90 miles from Batangas Bay to Manila. Now, bear in mind, they're fighting in the Philippines at that time. I mean, and where we had landed, there was a supply lane to a road that took from there up to Manila, where the supplies were taken. And we hitchhiked. It took us, I think, all day Saturday to hitchhike to Manila. And they were fighting all around Manila. And we went up there to have a liberty. We wanted to see what Manila was like. And we didn't see too much, but we got to drink some of that Manila gasoline in those days, that the bombing medicine that they gave you in those days. And we started hitchhiking back. We had to get back Sunday. You know, we had to report back to the ship. And it took us all day. Again, we got about probably 4 hours liberty in Manila, where we found a few places to have a beer or something like that. Of course, it was all 3-2 beer and that dough and whatever it was. And we could see the bay when we were coming back, and we'd hitchhike our last ride. We were practically walking, and general quarters sounded. And, of course, we had to get aboard ship as quick as we could because we didn't know what was coming. And when we got aboard ship and everything got settled down, a few planes came over and stuff like that. But those Japanese had bombed that road that we were hitchhiking on, all the way from Batangas Bay to Manila. And I told Hubbard, I said, do you realize how many gun sights? I mean, we were in the sights of, they could have picked us off any time, but that would have, that would expose their position. So we didn't get shot or anything. We got through the whole thing, but that was a narrow occasion, yeah.
I suppose so. A close call, to be sure. But you did make it home, and you got a chance to play a little baseball. And we have another half hour in the show. We certainly can't get in all the great baseball stories in this book, which is all the more reason for you, if you're listening today, to check out the book. And again, it's called Ozark Ike, Memories of Fence Buster Gus Zernial. I like one of the articles I was reading the other day where a newspaper writer described you as a pachyderm-sized slugger. You were playing for the Athletics at the time and had the elephant for the logo. But some great material in this book. We'll talk about more of that, some baseball stories with Gus, and we'll still get back to a prayer that he prayed when he first entered the Navy and how that all turned out for him. Gus Zernial is our guest. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Lattler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Baseball great Gus Zernial, the guest on Hometown Heroes today. All of his 237 home runs in the major leagues, the nickname Ozark Ike, being around guys like Connie Mack, a chance to meet Babe Ruth, a young lady named Marilyn Monroe at one point, too. We'll get to all that. So far, we've heard how Gus joined the Navy in 1942, spent 3 years serving our country. You heard him talk about his close call with that Japanese Q-boat in the Indian Ocean on the way to Calcutta, about that Liberty in Manila where he just missed being strafed and bombed by Japanese planes. But he survived World War II, made it back home, and in the process, Gus grew another inch and a half and added, I guess, about 50 pounds of muscle and maybe a little something else.
Yeah, I went in the Navy about 180, about 6 feet tall. I came out maybe 6'1", and then I came out at 6'2 and three quarters and weighed 230 pounds. But I was not a fat guy. I lifted a lot of weights, did a lot of running and working out in the Navy, so I was kind of bulky.
And they say the Navy will make a man out of you. In your case, it really did.
Well, it did for me. I think I've always attributed being a man growing up in the Navy. If you don't grow up in the Navy and go where the experiences I had, and you don't become a man after that, there's something wrong with you.
And because you grew so much and you developed into such a bigger, bulkier, slugger kind of body type guy, when you got back to minor league baseball, your manager, who was one of the all-time greats, a Hall of Famer, Kai Kyler, didn't really even recognize you. He said, who is this guy?
Well, Kai had seen me before I went into the service as a leadoff man weighing 180 pounds. And when I walked into the clubhouse in Atlanta, and actually, he didn't know who I was. I told him I was Gus Zernial. He said, what happened to you? And he got a fungo stick, and he chased me for 3 hours every day trying to. He thought he was going to get me back down to 180, but I never got below 220 in my life after that. So, but I became a slugger. My first year in baseball, I only hit 5 home runs in C or D ball. But then in my second year, when I went to Atlanta for spring training, they sent me to Burlington, North Carolina. And that was a jumping board for me because I think I hit, I know I hit well over 300. I drove in well over 100 runs, hit 40 home runs. I just had a big year at Burlington. I hit 336, I think it was. And I was drafted by Cleveland out of C-ball, which was unheard of in those days. And that really gave me a boost into the big leagues.
And as a result, you got to hang out with some guys like Bob Feller and Bob Lemon, Mike Garcia, a Valley guy. But eventually, you made your way to Hollywood in the PCL, and that's where you came about the nickname that is on the cover of this book now, Ozark Ike. And people my age don't know the comic strip. Explain to us how that nickname came about.
Well, we had a radio announcer at that time who later became manager of Pittsburgh in the National League. His name was Fred Haney. Good radio announcer. And there was a comic strip came out in those days, and it didn't last too long, but it was called, as I remember, it was Ozark Ike from Mudville. But when I saw the comic strip later, when I found out about it, it was different. But it was a big blonde-headed slugger. And Fred Haney said, man, we got the original Ozark Ike right here in Hollywood. And but that took place in 1948. I don't believe it was in 47, the first year. But in 48 is when it took place. And that name stuck. Everybody calls me Ozark Ike. Kids still write to me, and they tell me they didn't see me play, but their grandfather did, or something like that. But they call me Ozark Ike, and they want me to sign the ball or the picture as Ozark Ike.
And I'm sure you'll be signing a lot of books at Grizzly Stadium this year once the Grizzlies get their season going. Again, that name of that book, if you're trying to find it, is Ozark Ike, Memories of Fence Buster Gus Zernial. There will be some book signings eventually at Grizzly Stadium. For now, you can email gzernial@fresnogrizzlies.com if you want to get on the list to get one of these books. A fabulous read, and so many stories, we won't be able to touch on them all here. You talked about 1948 in Hollywood. By 49, you're in the big leagues with the White Sox. 51, you'd be traded to the Philadelphia A's, which is where you had your best years. But also in 1951, you happened to be in the right place at the right time for a young up-and-coming Hollywood blonde to pose for a few pictures with you.
Well, I know you're talking about Marilyn Monroe, and that's a topic of conversation, and only because of... probably because of Joe DiMaggio more than anything, but...
Or as Connie Mack called him.
DiMaggio.
Right. That's another story in the book.
That's another story. And but we took a lot of pictures. There's a lot of ball players. Eddie Robinson, Hank Majeski, Joe Dobson were all taking pictures. She was a very enlightening young lady, and you know, she was on her way up. And so in 1951, before I was traded from the White Sox to the A's, why a lot of these pictures were taken, and a lot of them got exposure all over the... You know, I'm getting a letter now from England. Somebody's writing a book, wants to know the story about Marilyn. But there's more to that Marilyn. I met someone from that class a little later on, and you see a picture of her in that book. She outdid Marilyn. I run into a gal after I retired from baseball. Not a gal, a young lady. Marla Sims, and she's now Marla Zernial. And
I like the way you put that in the book. You said, I convinced her to change her name to Zernial.
Yeah. Yeah, and she's been with me ever since and been my right-hand man.
I want to let you set the record straight here on Maryland. Obviously, people can get the whole story in the book. But as it comes about, DiMaggio is quoted as saying, what is she doing taking pictures with a busher like Zernial? He thought you were a bush leaguer, and he was a class above you.
He called me a lot worse than busher.
So I hear.
In his book.
In his book. Your book doesn't have that kind of language in it. But he became convinced that you started a story, that you were the one who introduced Marilyn to him, even though in your book it says that's not true.
Well, that happened in New York because I'd been traded to the A's, and we were going into New York in 19... if you remember, Joe's last year to play was 1951. And we were going into New York to play the Yankees. I was in left field for the A's, and Joe was in center field. Marilyn happened to be in New York at the same time, and she was plugging one of her movies. And so the writers got a hold of the idea because Joe had made the comment, which you just talked about, why should a busher like me get to me? Well, they arranged, according to them, an idea. Joe said he wanted to meet Marilyn. Well, they there was a meeting, obviously, that took place. But the writers always wrote it up that Gus Zernial introduces Marilyn Monroe to Joe DiMaggio, which is not really a true case. It was, it happened, we were all three in New York, but the writers thought that'd be a great, you know, they like to make stories. Well, they made that story, and it still goes today. I can't change it. But that's when Joe met Marilyn, and then later on, of course, in 1954, is when Joe married Marilyn Monroe. But Joe never talked to me very much after that, and I read some of his books. He wasn't very complimentary to me, but he thought I perpetuated that story that I introduced Marilyn to him, and he resented it. And I think he resented that I met her first. And but that was Joe. I mean, that happened to be the way Joe was. But that's as you read the book, you get the true story on how that all took place.
And he had his 56-game hitting streak. Now, 56 years after all that happened in 1951, we know the true story, thanks to Gus being on the program today, and you can read more about it in his book, Ozark Ike, Memories of Fence Buster Gus Zernial. Let's talk a little bit about baseball. We'll take some phone calls in a few minutes at 490-5858, 800-776-58. Obviously, when someone looks at your career, they look at the 1950s, and for that decade, you were as productive as anybody in the big leagues. Only two guys hit more home runs in the American League in that decade. Couple of Hall of Famers, Yogi Berra and Mickey Mantle. What did it feel like when you were this all-star, when you were hitting four home runs in a doubleheader, seven in four games, and setting records like that? What was it like to be Gus Zernial in the 1950s?
Well, you know, I knew that I could hit home runs in bunches, but I didn't even think of it being a record at the time. In the very beginning, when I was still with the White Sox, the last four home runs I hit for the White Sox was in a doubleheader against the Browns, I think it was. And I hit four home runs in that doubleheader, which nobody's ever hit five home runs in a doubleheader in the American League. Three guys in the National League have done it. Unusual, guy from Pittsburgh.
Nate Colbert did it, I believe.
And somebody like that.
Yep.
And but anyway, that was the beginning of it. And then when I was traded in 1951, the first seven home runs I hit that year was the record, seven home runs in four games. Yeah. That was quite a start in Philadelphia.
I suppose so. No wonder you became a fan favorite and were doing Gillette ads before you knew it. And one of those seven was an inside-the-park home run off of Dick Starr back on May the 15th. That was actually part of a doubleheader on May the 15th. Inside-the-park home run, there's got to be a story behind that.
Well, you know, I'm big-looking, but I could fly. I could run pretty good. But, you know, the way they would play me, the center fielder would almost be in left field. And I remember the three home runs. I hit three inside the park home runs. If I hit the park, hit the ball in the furthest part of the park, which is always center field, and in Philadelphia, that was over 450 feet because it was kind of square out there. And I got to second base before the outfielder ever got to the ball. So I made it pretty easy, and then most of them were done, well, they had to be done that way, but I could run pretty good.
And again, if you get this book, you can read about all the home runs, fantastic list in the back of all the home runs. You can see when he hit them off Hall of Famers like Bob Feller or Whitey Ford, all the guys that he took deep, and some stories behind that. You read about his injuries, his highs, and his lows. I want to touch quickly on a story about one of the most legendary baseball men that ever lived, Cornelius McGillicuddy, who everyone knows as Connie Mack. They know his famous hat. He wasn't the manager when you got to Philadelphia, but he was still the owner. And I understand only once did he ever call you by your first name?
Well, I don't think he called anybody much by their first name in those days. But Connie was still the owner. He traveled with the ball club, and he always came to spring training. And everybody would go up and speak to Connie Mack. I mean, here's a legend in baseball, and you just had to go up and speak to the gentleman. And I remember in Cleveland one time, I went up to say hello to Connie, and I stood in front of him, and he looked at me, and he says, I know who you are. And I thought he was going to name me by name, and he said, you're number 19. But later on, in spring training one time, I went into change sweatshirts before a game, and Connie would always go to the restroom after everybody else was out of the clubhouse. And I come running out of the clubhouse, and I almost ran over him. I mean, I did a dancing routine or something to avoid Mr. Mack. And he looked at me and he says, only time I remember ever saying my name was, have a good game, Gus. And I treasure that.
Obviously, it stuck with you all those years, and for good reason. We're going to take our last commercial break here. We'll be back with some of your phone calls at 490-5858, 800-776-5858. We're talking to baseball legend and World War II veteran Gus Zernial, Hometown Heroes, here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Coming down the home stretch of this Hometown Heroes this Sunday afternoon, it's been such a great privilege and a pleasure having Gus Zernial here. And, you know, all the years that I've done Bulldog baseball on the radio, it's given me great pride to know that I'm following in the footsteps of people like Gus Zernial and Lon Simmons, who called those Diamond Dog games long before I did. You know him from radio and TV in the Valley. You might have a baseball card of him. If you do, I'm sure he'll sign it for you when you see him at a Grizzlies game. He's a team ambassador still, and one of the big reasons that stadium is in downtown Fresno. We won't forget about that. You've heard him talk about his close calls in the Navy during World War II, some of the baseball stories. You even heard the true story behind the Marilyn Monroe, Joe DiMaggio story and those pictures back in 1951. And if you get his book, Ozark Ike, Memories of Fencebuster Gus Zernial, you'll also read about the most important three F's in his life. That would be family, friends, and faith, which brings me, Gus, to a story you told me that will also be on TV today on CBS 47 with Stories of Service at 6 o'clock. When you went into the Navy, you made a deal with God.
Well, yes, I did. Charlie, I was overseas, and, of course, on Sunday morning we would have chapel. And I remember I knew what I was in, but I wasn't afraid of the war. I was never afraid of anything, really. But I went to chapel one day, and I said, I respected my family very, very much. And so I went into chapel, and I was saying, I was sort of talking to the Lord, not praying. And I said, Lord, if you'll just get me through this conflict we're in, through the war, and let me play 10 years in the big leagues and live to be 70, I said, I'll speak of you. I'll do whatever it takes to shine a light the rest of my life. Well, obviously what happened, I'm here. The war didn't get me. And I played 11 years in the big leagues, a little more than 11. And so I made my 10 years. And I passed that 70 mark up a long time ago. I'm 84 years old. So he has answered my prayers. And I mentioned that, I think, in the book that here I'm still going.
He told me you're living on borrowed time, and if he keeps lending you more time, you might just shoot your age on the golf course one of these days.
Well, I always could break 100, so if I reach 100, I'm going to try to do that.
Well, let's take a few phone calls now as we come down to the last few minutes of the show. I do want to give our listeners a chance to talk to Gus a little bit. Z has been waiting patiently. Hello, Z. How are you?
Oh, hi. The only thing I want to tell Gus is that I'm 47 years old, and I lost my dad before I was 5. So I really didn't know him. But I used to see him on TV, and I used to say, God, I wish that was my dad. And since now that I'm 47 years old and him talking about the Lord, I know the Lord needs to be stronger in my life. He's such an inspiration to me, Gus. I just wanted to let you know that I've always looked up to you, and I used to just admire you. You were so handsome and so full of life and so vigorous, and every time you always cracked a smile, no matter how bad the problem or the issues that you were trying to discuss. And I really admire you for that.
Well, thank you very much.
And tell you that.
Beg your pardon?
I just wanted to tell you that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it very much. And if you do it the way I do it, I just take a walk every morning with the Lord, and I'm never lost. I'm always okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Z, and if you could be sitting where I was and see the look on Gus's face as you shared all of that, you know that your comments meant a lot to him and told him that everything that he's talked about in this book, that he's been doing the right thing, and that God has had a plan for him and worked everything out just the way it should have been. And that's one thing I get from this book, Gus, that you do have a part in there about your faith. And throughout the book, you just feel like you're sitting down with an old friend and hearing him speak from his heart. And I imagine that your intention was something along those lines.
Well, I was inspired by that a great deal. It goes way back to Northwest Church, Buf Carriker, the name you heard of, and so many of my friends like Tommy Summers and Jack Hanna, Bob Myers, I could go on, and John Gossett, I could just name them all along the line. Mal Dioren was a man that inspired me a great deal, and I thought about that a great deal when I wrote the book, and I was inspired by that, and I think in some of the areas of my book, it does come out. And I have a story in there about my greatest teammate. I don't have time to tell you that story, but you will enjoy reading that story.
I did enjoy reading that story, and I know our listeners will as well. Again, if you want to order the book, the thing you need to do at this point, there will be some public book signings. You'll have plenty of time, plenty of opportunities to see Gus in person, have him sign your copy for you. But for now, you can email gzerniel, that's Z-E-R-N-I-A-L, at FresnoGrizzlies.com, and he'll do his best to get you a book. Let's get one more caller in quickly before we close out the show. Art, you're on KMJ with Gus Zerniel. Hi, Art. Turn that radio down and talk to us. You bet.
Hello, Gus.
There you are. Hi.
Say, you mentioned Hubbard. Is Hubbard from California?
No, I think... oddly enough, Hubbard was from Hope, Arkansas, as I remember. So,
yeah, well, he could. Well, Hubert Hubbard.
I don't remember what the first name was. All I remember was Hubbard. He was a gunner's mate. But I think
well,
he was...
I'm going to find out from the daughter.
Okay.
You find out, Art, and use that email address I just gave you, gzerniel at
FresnoGrizzlies.com. No, I kind of know Gus when I used to see him in town in Fresno.
Well, track him down. Track him down after we're off the air.
Yeah, I'm going to ask the daughter. He's passed on. He was in the Navy.
Well, it might be the same one.
If you figure it out, you let us know. I think that would be a great postscript.
I sure will, Gus.
Thanks, Art.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling in, Art. We're just about out of time here, Gus, and I mentioned that you are going to have some book signings for this. I just want to say thank you for your service to our country back then. Thank you to your service to our Valley since then. You have been an ambassador not just for baseball but for the Valley. Everybody knows you. Everybody appreciates you. You've done a really great job on this book, and I'll tell you, I was entertained by each and every chapter, and I look forward to hearing everybody else share those same sentiments with you. Is there anything else that you would like to say to our listeners who I imagine are going to be reading this and giving you a lot of feedback?
Well, you know, I don't have an enemy anywhere. Everybody's is a friend. And if you hear the show or you want to mention the show, why, do so. I'll be at the ballpark almost every game this coming season. Not every game, but I will be having some book signings take place in the near future. And, Paul, I want to say to you and to your audience, it's been a pleasure being on with you, and I know you have aspirations probably of doing more and more in radio and television, and I think you certainly got the tools, as we say in the trade, to do so. So good luck to you.
Well, thank you, Gus. I appreciate that, and all I know is that God has a plan for each one of us.
That's
so whatever
right.
His plan is, I'll just follow as best I can.
Yep.
I want to thank all of you for listening to Hometown Heroes again this Sunday. Next week, we're going to focus on Pearl Harbor, talk to some Valley survivors of Pearl Harbor. And don't forget to watch Gus's TV story, CBS 47, at 6 o'clock. This is Hometown Heroes for this Sunday. You're listening to News Talk 580 KMJ.